This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Weekend Woman's Hour with me, Anita Rani. In a moment, we'll hear about co-parenting. How do you share the parental load once you've separated from your partner? And the film director, Eleanor Church, for her latest documentary, she embarks on an all-female expedition to the North Pacific Gyre, where much of the world's plastic waste ends up.
We found some microbeads, the things that you use in facial washes. So tiny, tiny, tiny pieces floating in this area that's one of the most remote places on the planet. So we were closer to humans on a space station than we were to people on land. We didn't see a boat for 3 weeks.
And I'll be talking football, more specifically the knee ligament injury known as the ACL, which stands for anterior cruciate ligament. As new research shows that female footballers are 6 times more likely to suffer this injury compared to their male counterparts. So no disruptions for the next hour, just you and the radio. But first, what's it really like to be a co-parent? How do you share the parental load once you've separated from your partner? Claire was joined by Hayley Allen, who's a fitness instructor. She has a 9-year-old son. He spends the weekdays with his dad and she takes care of him at the weekends. And Carly Harris, who is also a fitness instructor. She has 2 children, age 4 and 2. She cares for them 80% of the time. So often we talk about the animosity around this issue when there have been difficulties and serious problems in agreeing arrangements for children after a breakup. But we wanted to focus on the personal impact of being a co-parent. Hayley and Carly joined Claire to tell her about their 2 very different experiences. Claire began by asking Hayley about why she recently posted on TikTok to say she was a great dad.
Well, whenever I talk about my son living primarily with his dad, you obviously get a lot of criticism from both sides, men and women. And I didn't really think this was a thing until I started talking about it. And the double standard just really struck me that if I was a man, a dad, I would absolutely, by anyone's standard, be called an incredible parent. I do all the things. You know, I take him out the weekend, we have fun, I buy him extra stuff, I pay job maintenance, all those things. I would be an incredible dad. Women would find me incredibly attractive.
What happens now then? What kind of judgment do you get?
Oh, that I'm selfish. That's the main one, that I'm selfish. And I think it's more, someone commented something recently that, I don't mind the setup that you've got. It's the fact that you seem to enjoy your time when he's not with you. And I was like, well, excuse me, ma'am, what would you like me to do? Just sit at home crying? Like, I have free time that I didn't have before. Why do I have to be this suffering woman for you to be happy?
There's an expectation that you should be miserable if you're separated from your children.
Missing him endlessly. Well, no, I've got work and hobbies and a life, and I very much look forward to our weekends together, and I plan fun stuff. But I'm not going to sometimes pretend that I'm suffering and missing him and there's this hole in my life. You know, he's 10 now. Times change. This wouldn't have happened when he was 2 years old. Because, yeah, I was very much attached to him, as most mothers are.
Tell us how your situation came to be. Because, as you say, you did start off with him living with you.
Yeah.
So what developed? What happened?
A mixture of things. His father ended up having a bit more free time. I decided I want to do a bit more with my life. And he started to spend a little bit more time here and there at his dad's. A couple of nights here, a couple of nights here, a couple of nights here. And it just progressed to him messaging, can I stay at dad's another night? And then his dad, after about a year of that, his dad messaged and said, he's talking about living over here more. How do you feel about that? And I was like, how do I feel about that? Yeah, actually. Oh, yeah, I think I'm ready for this.
And it didn't feel like a wrench?
No, it didn't. And I'm very unapologetic in saying that. And I think it would be easy for me to pretend because that's what people want to hear.
Do you think you said the unsayable, but actually a lot of people, maybe a lot of people listening to this, or a lot of women listening to this, will think, I wish I could say that.
Well, this is what I get.
It's hard. It's very, very hard.
I get so many messages from women in my situation who don't tell anyone that they are not the primary carer because of the shame they feel and the criticism they are going to get. And they cannot face being called a terrible mother, being called selfish. And I know that's such a shame because men would, again, they just do not get the same criticism.
Let's bring in Carly Harris now. Carly, you have 2 children, age 4 and 2, and you look after them 80% of the time. You're a single parent. And it wasn't your choice to be in this situation, was it?
No, it wasn't. I've been a single parent for about a year now. That's just over. And for me, like the biggest struggle I had was time apart from my kids. Like I never planned on having children to not be with them all the time. I'd never even, you don't consider it until you're in that situation. And for me, when everything happened, my biggest fear was, oh my God, like I'm going to have to spend time apart from my children. And that's not my choice. Even particularly at the start, having those weekends away from my kids, I used to spend crying. And I think it does take time to adapt to it. Don't get me wrong, like over the last year, I've certainly started to adapt to it and I've started to make the most of my child-free weekends. And even then, like, I feel like I'm judged on like that small period of child-free time. I feel like I'm judged if I go away or go on a city break or something like that. I feel like people are very quick to judge any time away from your children, even if it's something that's not particularly your choice and how you're spending that free time.
So is this, do we get to the nub of this, which is there's an expectation that, you know, if you've split up and you're co-parenting, it's fine if you're a mother and you're miserable, but not if you're, you know what, I'm fine with that. I'm okay with that. I've got some time back and I'm living my life, which makes me a better mother when I'm with my child.
Well, being a woman is, guilt is ingrained in part of being a woman. Unless we're suffering and feeling guilty, people are just not very happy with you. And when you're doing something for yourself, when I go away, a lot of people go away. They go away with their husband for a little romantic break, but that's fine because she's serving her husband. The minute I go, no, I'm going to Venice with a book. And they're like, whoa, that's incredibly selfish.
Not taking your son?
Not taking my son. No, he's 10 and doesn't want to walk around Venice.
Carly, have you moved beyond this now? You say you're in a more comfortable place. I know you had a very difficult time, and it's only been a year or so, but you were on Mother's Day because of the childcare arrangements. You weren't with your son. And those kind of days, or your children, that's going to be a wrench, isn't it? But where are you on that journey to kind of saying, I'm all right with this arrangement now?
I'm not quite there yet, I'll be honest. I'm still experiencing quite a lot of firsts. Still, I think, well, I'm in the divorce process, so things aren't finalised yet. And I think for me, it's still adapting. Like, I'm not going to lie, I am one of those mums that even when I went on like a slightly longer trip last month and there was a bank, it was school holiday. So my ex-husband had the kids slightly longer. I think it was 3 nights or 4 nights and I'm only used to 2 nights max. And that kind of tipped me over the edge a bit. Like I had a cry and I'm still adapting to that. And I do struggle with that. And I think that's okay. I think it's okay from both ends. Like I've always been an incredibly maternal person. For me, like the one thing growing up, I knew I 100% wanted to be was a mum. I gave up my teaching career. So yeah, I mean, I'm making the most of my kid-free weekends. That doesn't mean I'm not struggling. I try and distract myself a lot and I am enjoying life again.
Claire speaking with Hayley Allen and Carly Harris there, and lots of you got in touch about this subject. Fola Demola said, I love time away from my children because I'm not just a mother, I am multiple things to multiple people and I want to fully enjoy all parts of my life. My children spending half their time with the only other person in the world that loves them as much as I do is the best thing for them, and for me, because I know they're loved and cared for, that gives me the headspace to care for myself and be ready to love and care for them when they're back home with me. Loving it. Now, delegates from 174 countries have been in Ottawa this week for the latest round of talks that have the aim of reaching a legally binding international agreement on plastic pollution. Since the 1950s, more than 9 billion tonnes of plastic have been produced, of which 7 billion tonnes have become waste, filling up landfills and polluting lakes, rivers, the soil and the ocean. Humanity now produces 430 million tonnes of plastic each year, two-thirds of which is contained in short-lived products. Some of that plastic gets into the food chain, where it has the potential to harm human health. One woman who cares enough about this to have travelled 3,000 miles to investigate the effect of plastic pollution in our seas is the film director Eleanor Church. Her documentary called X Trillion came out this week, and she takes the viewer on an all-female expedition to the North Pacific Gyre, where much of the world's plastic waste ends up. It's a brilliant documentary, and Eleanor joined Claire in the studio, and she began by asking her why the title X Trillion.
X Trillion really is because we don't know exactly how many pieces of microplastic are in the ocean. And we started off thinking about how many trillions of stars there are in the sky. And often that's compared to how many trillions of pieces of microplastics there are in the ocean around us on the boat. But there isn't an exact number. So we went for X.
Yeah, and it's very, very powerful. I mean, the expedition was to the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, and so we're very used to images of these vast floating rubbish dumps, but that isn't actually what we see in the documentary, is it?
So the Great Pacific Garbage Patch is thought to be three times the size of France, so it's a vast area. But as you say, it's not what people imagine it to be. And actually, we were sailing through this, it's called the North Pacific Gyre and the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. We were sailing through this for days and days and days, and actually it just looked like normal sea. And sometimes we'd see a chair float past or a toothbrush or something like that, a recognisable object. But most of the time, it actually just looked like beautiful blue sea. But then when we put the trawl through the water and pulled it up, we saw that actually there were many, many, many pieces of tiny fragments of plastic that are so small, and they've broken down through the sun and the waves, making the plastic smaller and smaller and smaller because it's travelled such a long way. And ultimately, plastic never disappears. It just breaks down and down and down. And that's really what the big issue is.
And it's becoming plastic sand, in effect.
Yeah, exactly. And people call it plastic soup. Mm-hmm. And we were able to see some of it just with the naked eye as tiny fragments, but some of it you have to look at under the microscope. And actually, amazingly, one of the things that I found extraordinary was that at one point we found some microbeads, the things that you use in facial washes. So tiny, tiny, tiny pieces floating in this area that's one of the most remote places on the planet. So we were closer to humans on a space station than we were to people on land. You know, we didn't see a boat for 3 weeks.
Why do they gather there? What's going on?
Well, luckily we had a geography teacher on board.
Andy?
One of the things about the expedition was that we all came from different professions. And so one of the people was a geography teacher, and she going to explain that it's the ocean currents that we have. We have one ocean, it's all interconnected, but we have all these currents that are pushing things around and act like whirlpools. And there are five main gyres in the world, and then smaller ones dotted around. And so it's a bit like when you pull the plug out of the bath, they go around and accumulate in this place. And yeah, it's the densest accumulation of ocean plastic in the world, and that's where it is.
Okay, so you were on this boat with women, many of whom hadn't met before. That must have been interesting. You had scientists, you know, you're the director making a film of all of this. There were vloggers, all kinds of women. How did it work out?
Yeah, so it was. So the expedition was organised by X-Expedition, and Emily Penn, the co-founder, has been on this mission for years to take women to see. What the real issue with ocean plastics are, and taking people from all different professions. So like you said, we had scientists on board, we had a geography teacher, we had an engineer, we had packaging designer, we had recycling expert, that was me. And yeah, we hadn't, and the idea is to see the issue of ocean plastics firsthand and what it really is, and to look at where the solutions are to it. And yeah, we hadn't met before getting on the boat, and we were all there because we really, really wanted to do this, and we're all really passionate and there with our own idea of what we were going to do. But actually, some people were saying before we left, you know, oh, it's going to be so intense. You're on this essentially quite small boat and there's no way of getting off, or you know, going for a walk around the block when you need a breather. But Emily did a really good job of setting the tone when we got on. And she was saying, you know, it's going to be really hard at times, but you just need to look out for each other and see if you're okay and be kind to each other. And it goes a long way. And it did. And I think we're bonded to each other for the rest of our lives.
And X Trillion is being screened around the UK and globally. Just check out the X Trillion website for details. And remember, you can enjoy Woman's Hour any hour of the day. If you can't join us live at 10 a.m. during the week, just subscribe to the daily podcast. It's free via BBC Sounds. And if there's a subject or an item you'd like to hear discussed on Woman's Hour, feel free to get in touch with us. You can email us via our website. Still to come on the programme, we'll be discussing perinatal suicide. Now, what do Arsenal's Beth Mead, Chelsea's Sam Kerr and captain of the Lionesses, Leah Williamson, have in common? Well, they're members of what's known as the ACL club, having all injured their knee ligament whilst on the pitch. The ACL, which stands for anterior cruciate ligament, is one of the key ligaments in the knee joints. It's common to tear it during sports that involve sudden changes in direction, like football. Research shows that female footballers are up to 6 times more likely to suffer this injury compared to their male counterparts. A new study is being launched by Leeds Beckett University, working with the likes of Nike, teams in the Women's Super League and the Professional Footballers Association to investigate this further. Former England defender and now women's football executive at the PFA, Fern Whelan, explained why this research is needed.
I think because now we've got more of an eye on the women's game. We know that it happened before when I was playing, when it wasn't so professional, when there wasn't cameras at every single game and there wasn't thousands of fans in the stadium. So it's not something new, but the fact that the game is now professional and we're asking players to be elite athletes and train up to six times a week, that is new. And that's something we want to delve into and see if that's having any kind of effect on players and the conditions that they're working in.
Well, why is this risk factor so high? Is physiology to blame, or rather a previous lack of investment in the women's game? I was joined on Thursday by Andy Williams, knee surgeon to the Sporting Stars at Fortis. It's a clinic here in London. He's conducted ACL operations on the likes of Manchester City's Chloe Kelly and Manchester United's Aoife Mannion and Emma Samways, who's a player for the third tier team Hashtag United in Essex. She tore her ACL in February of this year.
I was playing against Halifax in the semi-final of the Women's National League Cup, and I think, well, the pitch was it was deemed nearly unplayable, very muddy pitch, and in about the 70th minute, my foot got stuck in mud and I've twisted outwards and just heard a pop straight away. Continued trying to play for 5 minutes, but then had to hob off in the end.
And what was it like receiving that diagnosis?
Pretty terrible, to be honest, because I think I was trying to tell myself it wasn't that. I've seen, obviously, injuries of like Beth Mead and Leah Williamson. They go down sort of crying straight away, getting stretchered off the pitch. But I actually walked off, was walking for the next 10 days. But then when it didn't get better, I got an MRI scan and then got told by email that I've got high-grade ACL tear.
And I mean, they're at the top of the game. You play in a third tier team, and you're also a police officer for your day job. Yeah. So what's this injury meant in terms of your career?
Well, as soon as I got told I got the ACL tear, I had to go on to restricted duties, meaning I couldn't go out on front line. And then obviously since I had surgery on the 12th of April, and I haven't been able to go back to work yet. I'm just still recovering, and I think for the next 9 to 12 months I'll be either off sick or having to be on restricted duties still.
Goodness me. I'm going to bring Andy in here. Andy, what happens exactly when you tear your ACL, when it's injured?
So usually it is a result of an unplanned or something that goes wrong with rotation. So the femur, the thigh bone, will slip off the back of the shin bone. And as that happens, it tends to be restrained by the anterior cruciate ligament. It gets tighter and tighter and then pop. About 75% of people will be aware of that, and it breaks, then snaps back into place. And there's a huge spectrum of injuries. Some people stretch it off, and other people can carry on even. But it's a very, very important injury to diagnose early and treat properly.
Why are women disproportionately affected?
Yes, there's a lot of interest in it because of the high-profile players have injuries, particularly over the last year or so. And there are probably some factors which create increased risk, maybe related to menstrual cycle. Certainly for other injuries, that's the case. Also, the shape of the bones and how the limb lines up. But I do wonder if effectively blaming women as somehow being frail may not be the whole story. And there are also, I think this is a manifestation of really sexual discrimination, in that many of the women footballers I treated over the years have been less muscled, less athletic than the men. And the simple fact is that the interest and the money is behind the men's game. Boys are picked up very young. From that moment on, they get the best training, best strength conditioning. And so they're turned into athletes who can cope with the rigours of the game. Whereas the women are able to join late and they don't have all that preparation. They're now being expected to play at high level twice a week. They simply haven't been given the chance to develop the bodies that cope. Mm. And maybe in 10 or 15 years, if we can improve equality, then you'll find much less instance of female ACL. And all those other factors, the angles of the bones, the menstrual cycle, etc., may actually be quite a small predisposing factor.
Well, you mentioned that because there has been some new research in the press, and it's out today actually, a study that followed a women's club for 3 years that suggests that players are more likely to get injured at certain points in their menstrual cycle. Players were 6 times more likely to pick up a muscle injury in the days leading up to their period.
So that seems significant. Unfortunately, it was only on 26 players, and so it's of interest, but I wouldn't say yet we could accept that as absolute fact, but there probably is something in it.
When it comes to the operation and recovery, do men and women differ here?
Not really. I mean, the essential is that the surgery is done well, and following the surgery, the critical thing is restoring muscle strength and control. And so the rehabilitation is not only exhausting, but is very, very important. And if the women start off with less good nerve muscle control, then they probably need more.
Well, Emma's going through it right now. How is it? I mean, it must be, not only are you in pain, the psychological impact of you having to take time off work and not be able to play football.
Yeah, I mean, as soon as I found out, straight away I was very upset and thought my life was going to be on hold for a year, essentially. But I think from having the surgery, the initial 2 weeks of quite a lot of pain, I saw my physio for the first time last night. And I think just that mental side of saying, like, here's your programme, this is what stage you need to be at each month, has set me goals now. And I think mentally I can now start looking towards that and just trying to improve that each time.
And how was the process of getting your operation? Did you go through the NHS? Was that possible?
No. It was possible, but when I went to the GP, they said, would I like physio or a consultant appointment? So that kind of worried me straight away. And then they said it was 12 to 18 months just wait for surgery. So I think for me, it wasn't really an option because it would have been 12 to 18 month wait and then another 12 months recovery. So that's 2.5 years potentially out of football and my job. I set up a GoFundMe page in the end because I saw that other footballers at my level did that, and I managed to raise £5,500 for my surgery.
Andy, what do you think about that? It's not an ideal situation.
No, it's shocking,
it?
I think, being blunt. I mean, the delay to surgery is important because between the original injury and the operation, there is a risk of instability and doing more damage to the joint. And, it's an indictment of the system. And a first-team male player wouldn't be expecting to wait, and they'd be insured and covered by the club. Women now are certainly getting better treatment, but it goes back to my point about sex discrimination, really.
So what can we do to better support female footballers who join the ACL club?
I think we've got to popularise the fact that this is a very big injury, and even though we're very good at treating it these days, it has lifelong implications. And that we need to look at the research to make sure we understand why they're getting the injuries. But I suspect it may well be because they're not being given a fair crack of the whip from the beginning. They never get the opportunities the boys or the men get.
I want to wish you a speedy recovery, Emma.
Thank you very much.
How are you?
I'm okay. No, I'm better now. I think I can see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Do you want to ask Andy a quick question? We've got the top doctor in the land here.
Yeah, I mean, my one question, I think what I'm missing the most is about running. So I would like to know, what stage do you think running can be a goal for me?
So usually around 3 months you can start running, so around 12 weeks. But you should only run if you've got a good single leg squat on both legs, because when you run, as you land, you absorb impact through a good controlled muscle activity. So if you're very wobbly, then I would delay the running maybe to 4 months.
That's something to work towards.
Yeah, wonderful. I would love that we've been able to facilitate that. There you go. Emma Samways getting some very good advice from Andy Williams. And we got a statement from Halifax saying, we of course wish Emma a speedy recovery and hope that she receives the treatment and care she deserves to get her back playing as soon as possible. It's never nice to see a player from any team have this type or any kind of injury. Talk about being a new mother often comes alongside lots of gushing about that amazing bond with your newborn baby. How much they sleep, how much you don't, who in the family they resemble. But one thing we don't talk about as much is the mental health of pregnant women and new mums and what happens when it deteriorates quickly. Perinatal suicide, while thankfully rare, makes up 39% of maternal deaths in the UK. That's deaths that happen within 42 days of the end of pregnancy. So why does it happen and what can we do? King's College London have conducted the first study of its kind into perinatal suicide, looking at the experiences and thoughts of women who've attempted to take their own lives. Claire was joined by the lead researcher, Dr. Abigail Easter, and Crystal Wilkinson, who herself made a suicide attempt not long after giving birth. Here we hear from Crystal, who explained to Claire how her wider family had experienced mental health problems.
So my mum had had severe perinatal mental illness after both of her pregnancies, and she was hospitalised both times. We lost her when I was a teenager, and I had had prior mental health problems, you know, various different prior mental health problems. So, yeah, absolutely on our radar. But we'd actually spoke to a specialist perinatal psychiatrist even before getting pregnant. You know, it's kind of, this is a history. How do we go about this? Do I need to be on maybe medication? Had a plan that, you know, I'd be not taking any medication during pregnancy, but they'd put me on preventative medication at birth and I'd be closely monitored. And my pregnancy was fantastic. My birth was fantastic. And the first 3 weeks were fantastic. Completely in love, you know, all that bond, that rush of love that everyone talks about. Until my husband went back to work and it was me that was responsible for a baby. And that's kind of where, you know, I just fell apart because, I don't know, everything that I had in my mind that I'd be in control, we'd do these activities, you know, I'd know what I'm doing. I just felt wasn't there. I was just felt completely out of control, completely lost, really scared. And it just deteriorated very, very quickly. I didn't want to be on my own with him. So I was like driving around to my dad's house or friend's house just to have somebody for a few hours that it wasn't just me. In desperation, asking, please let me go in the mother and baby unit. And they did, they admitted me. And I think at that point, I was expecting that I would feel better, that it'd all be sorted out quite quickly. And I didn't feel that straight away. I felt just even more kind of isolated, even more scared. And I think the big thing for me was that I couldn't really articulate what was going on in my head, and it wasn't what I expected. So I'd expected depression, or I'd expected even like a manic sort of feeling, but it was just fear. It was just, I can't be a mum. I don't know how to be a mum. I've lost my identity. There's no going back. Trapped. But yeah, when I was in the mother and baby unit, I was desperate to be out. So I'd be like trying to, they decided I could go home for weekends with my husband. So you're kind of like, well, I don't want to seem too bad. So they don't let me go home. So, you know, and then when I was at home with my husband, I'd be like, I need to be back in the mother and baby unit. And there was, I just felt there was no way out. You know, nothing. I couldn't see anything getting better. I thought they're never going to let me be a mum. You know, my husband's probably going to see that I'm no good and leave me. I'm never going to be able to go back to work. Yeah, and that kind of just...
And how did you break that cycle? You say you were on medication post-birth, is that correct? So how did it finally level out?
It was difficult to know. It was a long process. You know, it was a long process and lots of support from different people. So I've got very fortunate that I've got an amazing close family and friends. You know, a number of medical professionals were involved. Medication was involved. I actually had a really, really supportive return to work. So that's kind of one of the things I'm trying to sort of talk about at the moment, is like workplaces need to be doing more about this, and managers to be aware. Because I think, you know, if any one of those relationships or parts of my identity had been taken away from me in that rebuilding phase, you know, I would have probably tried again, and I might have been successful with, you know, ending my life. So, yeah, I think it was a long process. It did take a long time.
How do you feel now?
I feel like I'm in the best part of my life ever. The bond I have with my little boy is incredible. He is the love of my life. You know, I'm so proud of him, and I don't know how we have the bond that we have, because I wasn't there, you know, at the beginning for a lot of the time. And even when I was there, it was like his dad was his person who looked after him, and I was kind of trying to help a bit. But, you know, and now I feel like every other mum, you know, that I see. And yeah, if anyone is listening who can relate to anything of what I said, just please hold on and please talk to somebody, because it does get better.
That was Crystal Wilkinson. Thank you to her for sharing her story. And you can hear that full interview on BBC Sounds. The episode was from Monday's programme, the 29th of April. And if you've been affected by anything you've heard in that conversation, there are support links and resources on our website. That's all from me, but do make sure you join me on Monday at 10 a.m. for our bank holiday special on how to age well. I'll be speaking to a fantastic panel of guests, GP Dr. Radha Modgill, comedian Kelly Beaton, writer Pippa Stacey, and author and psychologist Dr. Sharon Blackie. You will not want to miss it. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Wie Führung in Zeiten der Unsicherheiten und der multiplen Krisen geht, darüber sprechen wir in unserem Führungspodcast. Ich bin Kai Dierke.
Und ich bin Anke Huben. Seit 25 Jahren sind wir Vorstandsberater. Wir beantworten die Führungsfragen unserer Zeit, inspirierend und informativ.
Wir räumen mit den Mythen der Führung auf. Und wir geben an aktuellen Beispielen aus Wirtschaft und Politik konkrete Lösungsansätze.
Dierke und Huben, der Führungspodcast. Jetzt reinhören und souverän an der Spitze agieren.